welcome you all to our second case today, but have a special welcome for the constitutional law class from Viterbo University. Would the students please stand? And their faculty.
Great.
Thank you very much for coming. We invite students from all over the state to join us for a hearing. And when the students are given, if they accept the invitation, they're given material about the case that we're about to hear. They may engage in other activities relating to the case. They come to court. They hear the oral argument. And a justice is assigned each day to meet with the students and anyone else who wishes to meet with us. Meet with the students here right after this case and discuss the procedures the court uses to take a case, decide a case, mandate the opinion. We do not discuss the substance of the case and the substantive issues. So we welcome you all. This is a national award-winning program that we have run for many a year. Now that we've met the students, let me introduce the court to all of you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I'm the assigned justice to meet with the class today. On my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. On my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crux. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Annette Ziegler. And starting on the left end of the bench is Justice Michael Gableman, and seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I have only one other housekeeping matter. Would anyone like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you'd raise your right hand or left hand, we'll give you the summary. Hearing none, we will proceed with counsel. The matter is 12AP 829, Ronald E. Belding versus Deanne DeMolin. Arguing on behalf of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company representing the defendant for 25 minutes will be Attorney Cavelling. We will then hear from Attorney Gregory A. Pitts, who represents Ronald Belding and Antoinette Belding. 5 minutes, Kevin Lonergan, who represents the Wisconsin Association for Justice, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Capelli.
May it please the court, I am Claude Capelli, as you know from, as already stated. I'm here on behalf of State Farm. This is an uninsured motorist case. However, I think it has fundamental issues of statutory construction which have a bearing on separation of powers and protecting the separation of powers in this case, and that was the issues that I presented to this court and that this court accepted review on. Ronald Belding was injured on January 13, 2010 by an uninsured motorist while he was driving a Ford Ranger pickup truck he owned and insured with State Farm. State Farm has paid the uninsured motorist limit under that policy of $100,000 that described the Ford pickup truck that he was driving. This dispute concerns whether Mr. Belding is also entitled to additional UM coverage under a policy that described a Mercury Villager vehicle that Mr. Belding also owned. This focuses on Section 632.32.5J, which was enacted in 1995, that specifically authorized an exclusion, a particular exclusion, that applied to uninsured motorist losses resulting from the use of a motor vehicle that is one owned by the policy's named insured or resident relative. So in this case, would be owned by the named insured of the villager policy, which was Mr. Belding, is not described in the policy under which the claim is made, is not described in the villager policy, and is not covered as a newly acquired or replacement vehicle under the villager policy.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? At the time of the legislative enactments, not the governor's veto, but at the time the legislature acted, do you think they intended to allow someone to recover under three policies?
Is this before or after the veto? Before the veto,
without the governor's veto. If you're just looking at, here's what the law is that the legislature passed, and here's what they intended to do. Then we'll get to the governor. But start with that. Is that where the legislature really intended this to begin and end for?
Well, it's where they intended it to begin, because they would have, but for the veto, prohibited.
Yeah, I'm not at the veto yet. The legislative intent was to do what? Maybe I should have you just answer the question.
Well, before the veto, the legislative intent was to pass a statute that basically took 5J, converted it to a prohibition, and put it in subsection 6. So, in answer to your question, yes, they did intend to eliminate the drive other car exclusion. They did intend to have a change the law that once allowed insurers to prohibit any stacking to limit them to stacking only three policies.
Okay. And then the governor vetoed that second
governor
part of it.
Governor vetoed the change to 5J, and the legislature did not override that veto, so that became the legislative action.
So in my mind, those seem to have competing purposes. They seem to contradict each other, don't they, to you?
No.
How are they the same? You can recover under three policies and stack them up unless the insurance company says you can't.
Okay. Uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage started in the 1950s and in the 1960s. Policies always had drive other car exclusions and other insurance clauses. They are two separate provisions. They do two separate things. The exclusion is an exclusion, which means it prohibits coverage that would otherwise exist but for the exclusion. Other insurance clauses, on the other hand, do not exclude coverage. Rather, they limit the monetary recovery when more than one policy does, in fact, provide coverage for the accident.
So how many policies would have provided coverage?
Pardon me?
Under this policy, how many policies provide coverage?
Only one.
Right.
Because the drive other car exclusion excluded the coverage. So the other insurance clause never comes into play. In other words, these two clauses operate in a mutually exclusive manner. And I think if you look at the policy, the villager policy itself, I think that's exemplified. For example, the policy contains a drive other car exclusion that follows what this court described as the three elements of a legitimate, bona fide, authorized drive other car exclusion. One of which is that that vehicle is owned by the named insured under the villager policy and is not described in the villager policy.
Maybe I should just get to the end run as to what I need you to answer for me today, and then I'll be quiet for a while. It seems to me like the legislature was trying to expand what someone could cover.
They expanded
what someone could recover.
They expanded it in many ways, but they did not expand it with respect to the drive other car exclusion. They maintained that statute and its exemption from the stacking requirements of 63143 without changing one word of that statute or without changing the exemption in any form. Now, the question is there a conflict between passing 6D.
See, now you're reading my mind. This is almost here. Now I'll give you my final question. Doesn't that create an automatic ambiguity in the policy such that it has to be construed in favor of the insured?
No. Well, first, I think the threshold question is there a statutory conflict? Is there an ambiguity between the legislature affirmatively deciding in 2009, we're going to keep 5J? And I think if you look at the governor's veto message, I think it's helpful. And that's basically his veto message said, Section 3172 prohibits insurers from denying coverage for an accident if the vehicle is not described in the policy under which the claim is made. I am vetoing this provision and cross-references to this section because it may increase the cost of premiums. So, in other words, the legislature did a lot of things to broaden coverage. They got rid of reducing clauses. They modified the other insurance clause to say you can't limit stacking to less than three cars. But the governor said, hey, if we get rid of 5J, the drive other car exclusion, it may increase the cost of premiums, and I think it's implicit because he vetoed it. He thought too much. It may price out those families that are not as well off as other families. In other words, Act 28 did not broaden the choices the consumer in Wisconsin had. It narrowed them. In other words, Act 28 was not needed for an insured to buy higher limits. They could always do that. What Act 28 did was raise the bar for the minimum coverage. It increased the minimum of UM coverage from 2550 or 5100 to 100-300. It required underinsured motorist coverage of 100-300. If you also got rid of the drive other car exclusion, say you have a young family with two cars. They need two cars because they both drive to work. They're a young family. They have to buy now at least 100-300 of uninsured and underinsured coverage. And it can't have a reducing clause. And it can't have a clause that eliminates stacking, another insurance clause. And if you didn't have a drive other car clause, they, when they bought $100,000 on each of their two cars, would have to have stackable $200,000 coverage. They would have to pay for that. It doesn't come free. You don't get double your money without an increase in the premium. So these young families, the governor thought, maybe they can't afford this insurance. So their choice is either get this minimum amount of insurance or don't get any insurance. And so they vetoed the drive other car exclusion. Now, the drive other car exclusion is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, it helps the insurance company be able to understand the risk it's insuring. Just like liability coverage, which has drive other car exclusions, and as this court explained in Agnew, they insure principally the car. In other words, risks arising from use of the described vehicle. If you don't have the drive other car exclusion, and there's three cars in the family, let's say you insure three of them, but there's a cousin living in the family who has two cars, you insure all five of those cars when they're on the road. Now, they can only stack it three times, but you may be insuring people you don't know of and cars you don't know of. So instead of having three cars on the road, each with a limit of 100,000 UM coverage, you have five cars on the road that you may have to stack coverage on, some of whom you don't even know about. So the insurance companies want this drive other car exclusion because it helps them identify the risk that they're insuring so they can set a reasonable premium, and uncertainty causes premiums to be higher.
Is there anything in this record regarding premiums, the cost of premiums,
In this fact situation, we have your company insuring both vehicles, but in a lot of situations, you have companies, different companies. You asserted that perhaps buying $200,000 of coverage would be more than buying $100,000 of coverage. Is there anything in the record regarding this?
Yes. The governor's statement why he vetoed it.
Okay, other than the governor's phrase of the cost to consumers, but I mean in terms of dollars and cents, do we have anything?
Well, first of all, it isn't the same as buying $100,000 on each of two cars or buying $200,000 on one car. It's the difference between having $100,000 on each car or $200,000 on each car and having each of those cars on the road at the same time, exposing the company to not $100,000 but $200,000. So, yes, there would be some increase in premium. There is nothing in the record that quantifies that. You're correct.
I think the only thing that I saw was the reference to consumers. I think it's necessary to protect consumers. And that's what he said.
Mr. Covelli, it seems to me your opponents are saying that 6D simply overrides 5J. You say they can coexist very nicely.
Yes.
Okay. What is the continuing value of 6D if, in fact, 5J is there and operates in full?
First of all, 5J is not a required exclusion. It's an optional one. Some insurers use it. Some insurers do not. So there are plenty of insurers that insure without a drive other car exclusion. So consumers have a choice. Do I want to buy it with the exclusion or without? Those that don't have the exclusion, for example, if they insure three cars or five cars, if they don't have the 6D limit on stacking that they can put in their policy, they would end up stacking five times their limits. So if I have a fleet policy and I insure 20 cars, all right, without 6D, where I can put a provision in that says you can't stack more than three, I would have to stack 20. So I'd have to have $100,000 for each of the 20 cars stacked 20 times, which I think turns out to be $2 million a car. All right. You also have pedestrian situations, and you also have non-owned car situations where the drive other car exclusion would not apply and where the limitation under 6D would apply. So there are plenty of uses for 6D, and it is, again, a limit on – initially, when the legislature first proposed it, there was no limit. It just said you can't eliminate stacking, which, of course, would have really created havoc as soon as you had a fleet policy with more than five or six or seven cars. You would get into astronomical stacking numbers. So there is –
Let me go back here. If a drive other car exclusion is included in all the relevant policies, you're saying that 6D still is important for what reason?
Okay. If the policies all have a drive other car exclusion, the drive other car exclusion doesn't apply in a situation where I am injured as a pedestrian. Because I am not using a vehicle I own. The accident, my injury doesn't result out of a vehicle I own. In that situation, even if the policy had an exclusion, it doesn't apply. And therefore, the policy provides coverage that all three policies provide coverage. Let's use three for example. And you can stack up to three. If you had five policies and you were the insured on all of them and you were injured as a pedestrian, you could have a provision that says you can only stack three of the five. So it would apply there. It would also apply if you're driving your neighbor's car, a non-owned car. It's not a vehicle that you own. It would apply in that circumstance. So, again, it is a limit. It serves a different purpose. And I think that's what this court said in Blavkovic. Because in Blavkovic, we had a situation before 6D. At the time of Blavkovic, it was 5F, which said an insurance company can have a provision that says you can't stack at all. All right? And the question in Blavkovic was, we've got a drive other car exclusion here. Oh, it doesn't meet the requirements of 5J. Is it okay? Or is it prohibited? And this court said, you know, it didn't say, well, 5F says you can have a clause that prohibits any stacking. And at worst, that's what this drive other car exclusion does. So if they're the same thing, this drive other car exclusion should be good. But the court didn't say that. The court said it's separate. It stands alone. This drive other car exclusion is separate and apart from the other insurance clauses. It serves a different purpose.
If instead of the 100,000, 100,000, the Beldings had the car that was driven, they had 100,000, but they also had a policy on another car for 200,000. And I'm talking before the legislative change regarding the three policies, okay? So pre-2009 or
all
whenever.
Right, before Act 28.
Right. And the same accident occurred. Wouldn't they be able to recover $200,000?
No.
What would they recover?
They would recover, the drive other car exclusion would allow them to recover on the vehicle that they owned, that the accident resulted from. They would not be able to recover under the policy, under the other policy describing a car not involved in the accident. So they wouldn't be able to do that. And then, of course, even if they were in a non-owned car, they couldn't stack those policies. That, in that case only would they, or if they were a pedestrian, they would get the highest limit, which would be the $200,000.
Okay, so they.
But if they're in their car before Act 28, one policy would apply unless they were in a non-owned car or unless they were a pedestrian.
So they're in the exact same position after Act 28 that they were before?
Yes, because they kept 5J without amendment, and they exempted 5J from the stacking statute, 631, 43 sub 1, which is a very broad statute and says if you have coverage that provides the same coverage for the same loss, you can't reduce the coverage below the aggregate. And the legislature continued that exemption. And that's my point. The object, the starting point is this. The legislature didn't, by mistake, keep 5J. 5J was up for repeal. It gets vetoed. The veto doesn't get overridden. So the legislature is deemed to know it's out there, number one. They're deemed to know that it had been construed in Blavkovic and what the elements were. They keep the exemption from the stacking statute. At the same time, they enact 6D. I think that's conclusive proof that they intended both be fully enforced. Fully enforced. Now, the job of the court is to find a way, if it can, to interpret these two statutes so that they both can be fully enforced. 5J had been interpreted already, and it clearly applies if the vehicle that the injury results from that's owned by the insured is not described in the policy. The governor's veto says, I'm vetoing the change that would have resulted in prohibiting an exclusion if the vehicle is not described in the policy under which the claim is made. So everybody knew that. When you look at 6D, it is much narrower than 631, 43 sub 1, the anti-stacking statute that started all this. That applies to the effect. On the other hand, 6D prohibits a particular type of clause. It prohibits a clause that says, it says, no policy may provide that, quote, the limits for any uninsured motorist coverage may not be added to the limits for similar coverage applying to other motor vehicles. The drive other exclusion does not say that. The drive other car exclusion applies whether there's other insurance or not. It does not violate 6D.
Counsel, as I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it in part rests on its interpretation of 5E. And we have been talking about 6D and then about 5J, but perhaps we can segue to 5E, and you can tell me why you think the Court of Appeals is wrong in resting part of its interpretation on the interaction with 5E.
Yes, and it's not here as number one on my list, so I got sidetracked.
Return now to those thrilling days of the beginning of your argument.
632.32.5 is a freedom of contract, freedom of enterprise provision. It says insurance companies may but do not have to use certain provisions that restrict coverage. In other words, we're going to let the enterprise competition determine what's offered to the consumer. 5E was a catch-all provision that basically said any exclusion not prohibited in sub 6 or some other statute is okay. You can use it. In other words, it's a catch-all. Now, 5J is in this same subsection. It expressly authorized a particular drive other car exclusion that had to meet three requirements. There is absolutely no reason that once having been authorized by 5J, it would have to be authorized a second time by the catch-all provision. It was already authorized. I know of no statutory rule of construction that says you have to authorize something by statute twice. There is no requirement of redundancy. And certainly Blavkovic doesn't stand for the proposition that the 5E analysis applies at all. In Blavkovic, it was undisputed that the drive other car exclusion did not meet the 5J requirements. Therefore, the only way it could pass muster is if it was under 5E. So it presented a totally different position. If our exclusion didn't meet the requirements of 5J, I would agree totally. We'd have to comply with 5E, and we would have a 5E analysis. But 5E doesn't apply here at all.
The Court of Appeals accuses, I think that's the right, I don't want to be too strong, but suggests that you're totally ignoring 5E in your analysis. What?
No, I'm not ignoring it. I'm saying it doesn't apply. I'm saying if the legislature says you can use this exclusion in 5J, there is no need to look at the catch-all provision to see if it would be independently authorized by 5E. It's already authorized. It's explicitly authorized. It's defined in detail authorized, and it's exempted from the stacking requirements. So why would it have to be authorized a second time? And I think what your analysis, Justice Bradley, and Blavkovic was, and I see my time is up, and I'll just finish
May
this
finish.
Point. Thank you. The point that you made in Blavkovic was that we have a statute, 5J, that authorizes a particular drive other car exclusion that has to meet all three requirements. That's the only thing that is exempted from the stacking statute of 631.43, which requires aggregate coverage. This provision did not meet that provision. So it couldn't qualify under 5E because it's prohibited by the stacking statute 631.43 sub 1, which says you got to aggregate it unless it's exempt. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Covelli. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Pitts, representing the buildings.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I represent Mr. Belding, who made his way from Kenosha, Wisconsin here today to hear his case, which he, I'm sure, had no expectation of ever reaching this court. But now that we're here, we're happy to be here and happy to give our thoughts on why he should be entitled to collect, or at least access, which is the real question here, additional UM coverage on a vehicle that he purchased and paid for under the law that governed the accident and the policies in issue. I'm compelled to continue on the points that were just recently discussed because that, in essence, is this case. And Justice Bradley asked Mr. Covelli why there had been no discussion of Section 5E, which was the cornerstone to the Court of Appeals' decision in this matter. And the answer is because that's the key to the case for us and fatal to State Farm's position in this case. The section in question, 5E, is the key to harmonizing any perceived conflict between 5J and 6D. 5E has been on the books since 1979. When the legislature enacted 5J in 1995, it is presumed to act with knowledge of the statutes in existence at the time, as well as the case law interpreting them. 5J authorized a drive other car exclusion. That is true. But when it was enacted to read much broader than strictly to UM and UM coverage. The Blazkowicz case followed the directives of the legislature in 5E to use the two-step test that's used to analyze any policy exclusion. That's not something this Supreme Court made up. That's something that was derived from Section 5E, because 5E explicitly states a policy may provide for exclusions not prohibited by subsection 6 or other applicable law. It is our position, as was stated by the Court of Appeals, which is why we're asking for an affirmance, that 6D is the subsection under sub 6 that prohibits application of a driver of the car exclusion to bar the stacking of coverage.
Counselor, if you're right, what does 5J ever apply to?
Thank you, Justice. 5J is not eviscerated by the enactment of 6D. 5J continues to be a permissible, optional exclusion, and it does apply to certain circumstances. First of all, it still applies for its primary purpose, which was the purpose of driver-other car exclusions in the first place, to prevent what we call the free rider problem, wherein a person buys multiple vehicles, only insures one, and then seems to use that insurance on the other vehicles that it owns, primarily for liability. Secondly, it still has...
What would you be stacking? If one was insured and one had no UM coverage, then what would you stack under 5J under your example?
Well, I was talking about liability situations, but in terms of an uninsured or underinsured situation like this case, it still has a place. It still prevents stacking of policy limits over and above 3, because if you use the two-step formula derived from 5E, whenever you confront an exclusion, you compare it to any prohibitions under 6. 6 says you're allowed to stack up to 3 insured vehicles. Once the stacking of 3 insured vehicles occurs, nothing else would prohibit application of 5J from barring stacking of any additional coverages. Thirdly, it would still apply to uninsured vehicles. This goes to your question, which was what happens if you only have UM insurance on one vehicle but you own others? In that situation, if you're involved in an accident and the accident vehicle is the one carrying the UM coverage, the driver of the car doesn't apply, you get your UM coverage limit. If you're using a vehicle that you own that is not insured with UM coverage, you're not able to stack the UM coverage on a separate owned vehicle because the driver-other car exclusion applies.
If you only have coverage on one vehicle, though, there's never anything to stack.
Right. You wouldn't be able to my point is you wouldn't be able to access that UM coverage on a non-involved vehicle that you own and insure if you are using an uninsured vehicle that you own at the time. And here's why. 6D states, no policy may provide that regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, claims made, vehicles or premiums shown on the policy or premiums paid, the limits for any uninsured motorist coverage or underinsured motorist coverage under the policy may not be added to the limits for similar coverage applying to other vehicles. So the point is that 6D anticipated a situation where insurance companies would attempt to include anti-stacking clauses. The case law talks about breeds of drive other car exclusions and anti-stacking exclusions. The legislature was aware that there are various ways that insurance companies can try to eliminate coverage or avoid stacking of coverage. 6D was enacted to prohibit that and to specifically allow stacking of up to three policies. So I want to go back to 5E because it is critically important here. And I disagree with counsel's statement that Blaise Kovic didn't follow 5E. It absolutely did. If you read the decision, it specifically goes through 5E and talks about how this court must apply a two-step process based on 5E, and specifically at paragraphs 12 and 13 of that case. Quote, we begin our statutory interpretation with an examination of the language of WSSTAT 632-5E, which states that a policy may provide for exclusions not prohibited by sub 6 or other applicable law, close quote. The court continues, based on the statutory language, this court has fashioned a two-part test to determine the validity of a particular exclusion.
What paragraph are you reading from, counsel?
That's paragraph 12, Your Honor. Now I'm going on to paragraph 13. First, the first step, we must direct our focus to 632.32.6 and decide whether the exclusion fits the description of any of the enumerated prohibitions. If it does, the matter is resolved and the exclusion is invalid. That is what the Court of Appeals held in this case. That is exactly the holding that this Court should reach in this matter.
Well, is it your interpretation then that 5J is or other applicable law under 632.32.5E?
Yes, Your Honor. You will see that the court in Blaise Kovic found that there was no prohibition under sub 6 that barred the drive other car exclusion because, again, this was in 2000. This was before Act 28 in 2009. The exclusion passed step one. The court then went to step two and examined any other applicable law that would bar the exclusion. It was at step two that it examined the drive other car exclusion with sub 5J. And because the exclusion in that policy did not conform to 5J, the court held that 5J was the other applicable law that prohibited the exclusion. It's clear in the case that the court went through those two steps. 5J was only looked at as the other applicable law after it looked to sub 6 to see if there was a prohibition, and there was not. Why is 6D a prohibition in this case? If you read the language, which conveniently counsel did not quote from when he quoted the statute, it says, no policy may provide that uninsured motorist coverage may not be added for similar coverage. And it has the language, quote, regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, claims made, vehicles or premiums shown on the policy, or premiums paid. It is that operative language that prohibits use of a drive other car exclusion to bar stacking of coverage. The drive other car exclusion essentially says if your vehicle isn't included on this tangible contract, you can't access it. That gets us into this area where we look at what's the objective of the legislature here. The objective of the legislature is to allow stacking of up to three vehicles, regardless of whether all the vehicles are identified on one contract or multiple contracts. We have the inter-policy stacking issue versus an intra-policy stacking issue. Why would the legislature prohibit stacking under 5J when you're dealing with multiple policies in inter-policy situation like we have here, but expressly prohibit anti-stacking clauses and, in essence, mandate stacking of up to three vehicles if it's on one policy? That doesn't make any sense. The only reason the drive other car exclusion comes into play here is because State Farm issues separate physical policies for each vehicle. Had Mr. Belding's Mercury Villager been identified on the declaration sheet, on the same declaration sheet as the Ford Ranger he was operating at the time, driver of the car would never have applied. We wouldn't be here today.
Let me ask. I'll go back to what Justice Ziegler asked at the beginning. The legislature wanted effective legislation on stacking, particular goal, and it took provisions from subsection 5, including 5J, and sought to make them prohibitions in subsection 6. Okay, and they succeeded in a number of different places. But they didn't succeed on that one simply because the governor vetoed it. Now, I think what you're arguing is that had virtually no effect with respect to the drive other car provision.
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the drive other car exclusion is still permissible, and the by virtue of the governor's veto, they are still valid exclusions. They are permitted under 5J in auto insurance policies. And in effect, 5J broadens the permissive scope of that to any coverage under the policy, is the language. Again, it's not specific to UM or UIM, but rather to any coverage under the policy because it serves a function. The drive other car exclusion permitted by 5J serves a function, and that function is to prevent primarily the free riding situation, which is what I talked about earlier. 5J essentially codified the holding in Agnew and essentially overturned the Welch decision. But what 5E does, Your Honor, is it says, before any exclusion can apply, we have to see if it's prohibited by sub 6. And so 5E directs us to sub 6, where we get to 6D, and we see that no anti-stacking clause is permitted up to three vehicles. Over and above the three vehicles, 5J still would bar additional coverage or additional stacking. In the UM context, 5J is essentially an anti-stacking clause. That's what it does. And there's no question that the legislature intended to prohibit anti-stacking clauses with WIS Act 28. But looking at
could I ask you sort of a rhetorical question? You talk about the free riders. Why is it that if somebody owns five vehicles and has five policies, you can't get to the fourth and fifth because that's free riders. But you can get to the second and third.
Okay. You first have to look at whether these five vehicles, as you identified, are insured or not.
Yeah, they're all insured. All insured.
They're all insured. There's no coverage anyway to access. All right? So what 6D does is it says if you do insure three vehicles. In this case, Belding has insured two vehicles. They paid the premium for them. You're allowed to access those coverage limits up to three if you have three. If you have five, you still only get to access up to three.
Why?
That was a decision the legislature made.
What's the rationale for that? If the insured has paid for five policies, and that's good public policy to be able to access all of them.
Well, my objective here is to enforce the laws as they're written, not to develop the policy or question the motives. But I do want to go back to the veto statement because that was another
point. Before you do that, my assumption is that the insurance companies wanted to limit it to three. Did they lobby for three, or don't you know?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The veto statement by then-Governor Doyle, which was quoted by Mr. Covelli, read as he indicated, but it also continued. Where Mr. Covelli left off, the statement continues, quote, but I am retaining separate provisions that allow the stacking of coverage limits for up to three vehicles owned by the insured. The legislature is presumed to act with knowledge of the laws on the books and the case law interpreting them. When they created 6D, they are presumed to know that it would bar the anti-stacking effect of 5J or any other anti-stacking clause in a policy up to three insured vehicles. And I think that that is clear, and it is consistent with this court's analysis of this issue. Blaise Kovic case, I think, is the strongest case we have, because in that case, it looked at a drive other car exclusion, similar to this one, although this one admittedly does comply with 5J. But it's the analysis that is what's crucial that was done by this court in Blaise Kovic. And in that case, it followed the directives of the legislature under 5E to follow this two-step test. If you don't pass step one, the exclusion is invalid, period. That's what 5E says, that's what this court has said, and that's why the Court of Appeals ruled the way it did. Now, even if you were to assume or hypothetically disregard 5E and you're stuck with 5J and 6D, the question would be, how do you reconcile that conflict? As I said in my opening remarks, 5E is the cornerstone. It cures the problem. But without 5E, then you have to admit there's a conflict there. And then in that situation, you're looking at a permissible, optional exclusion under 5, and you're comparing it to a very specific prohibition under 6. The law says that when there are conflicting statutes, the specific prevails over the general. In this case, both of these statutes are within 632.32, so we're dealing with separate subsections. It's almost like a situation where you have a provision and then you have a number of exceptions to that statute below it. Additionally, not only do you seek to enforce the more specific, but you enforce the latter enactment, because again, you're assuming the legislature knows what's on the books when it creates a new law. I submit to you that 5J, as a permissive general statute applying to any coverage, is trumped by 6D, which is specific to uninsured motorist coverage or underinsured motorist coverage. Because 6D was enacted subsequent to 5J. So even if we don't have 5E to guide us, I think the conclusion is that 6D prevails to bar the driver of the car exclusion in this scenario.
So do you want to bite at all on the idea that a reasonable insured wouldn't know what they're getting with respect to coverage given the conflict in the statutes?
Well, I think that the question of what a reasonable insured would believe he or she has is the question that you have to ask when there's an ambiguity in the policy. And certainly that is an argument that could be made here in a contextual sense. If you look at the drive of the car exclusion, which says there's no coverage unless you're hurt in the vehicle described in this policy, versus another section of the policy which says you're able to stack up to three uninsured policies, that creates some ambiguity there. And ambiguities, as we know, must be resolved in favor of coverage. But I think the answer to the issue before this court is given to us by the legislature in 5E and by this court's precedent interpreting 5E and applying it to exactly this type of exclusion, the drive other car exclusion.
Mr. Covelli argues that 5E was intended to promote sort of freedom of contract. And it seems to me, I think it's the Clark case, interpreted 5E in a situation where the insurer developed something as a clause, an exclusion, without any statutory authority for that. So it seems pretty clear that a prohibition in 6 would override something.
Right, Your Honor. In fact, the Clark case dealt with a territorial exclusion. Again, there, this court used the two-step test derived from 5E to address the validity of that territorial exclusion. There were no prohibitions under sub 6 to bar it. It then looked to the second step. Was there any applicable law to bar it? And the court could find none. Therefore, it was enforced. And Mr. Covelli's argument that 5E is a freedom of contract issue, that may be well and true, but freedom of contract is not unlimited. Freedom of contract is guided within the confines of the law. And the law, in effect, at this time was 6D, which prohibited anti-stacking clauses in the UM context. That's exactly the situation we have here.
Would it prohibit anti-stacking clauses if the insurance policy had been issued before the law took effect?
No. The law only applied to policies issued or renewed on or after November 1, 2009. This policy was renewed, I believe it was like November 13th or something. But there's no question that this policy was renewed after Act 28 became in force. There's no question that it governs the policy. There's no question that Mr. Belding was insured under the Mercury Villager policy for UM coverage, which is why we look at the validity of the exclusion. I mean, that's the analysis that has to be done. There's no question there that he was covered as an insured under the UM policy consistent with the statutory definitions of UM coverage. State Farm is attempting to avoid access to those coverage limits by way of the drive of the car exclusion. Hence, we have to analyze what is the validity of that exclusion, and the way we do that, as taught to us by this court and by 5E, is we apply that two-step test. When we do that, there can be no question that 6D prohibits its effect in this situation. No
counsel?
More questions. I think I'm finished.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lonergan, representing the amicus.
May it please the court. As you indicated, I'm Kevin Lonergan. I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Association for Justice. I'll try not to be too repetitive here, but I think it's really important to go back to the kinds of clauses that Chapter 632 permit or not permit in insurance policies. You've seen it in the briefs. We can have a mandatory provision within a policy, certain provisions that are prohibited and others that are permitted. So we have mandatory, prohibited, and permitted. We're not dealing with a case here where we're trying to decide whether a mandatory provision conflicts with a prohibited provision. We're dealing with a situation here where we have a prohibited provision, and we have to determine whether or not it conflicts with a permitted provision. And how do we do that? Well, the Wisconsin legislature in 1979 made it very clear under subsection 5E that prohibited always, always trumps permissible. And this court in Clark and this court in Blazkowicz approved that methodology. So the first thing that we do when we're trying to analyze a prohibited versus a permissible provision is go to 5E, which is what the court in Blazkowicz told us we should do. State Farm wants us to go to 5J first. They want us to go to the permissible provision and see if it can trump a prohibited provision. That's not what the statute says. That's not what this court said to do. And it's also important to note that in 1995, the legislature had a statute which was 5F that permitted anti-stacking clauses in insurance policies. They made it very clear that insurance company could include them. In 2009, our legislature could have merely removed the authority, the grant of authority in subsection F by just deleting subsection F. But they went way beyond that. They took subsection F and made it a prohibition to have any kind of language that would prevent the stacking of policies in uninsured and underinsured motorist cases up to three. They put it in subsection 6. They didn't just remove it from 5. They put it in 6. And they would have put it in 6 with the knowledge that the legislature had already made it clear that the analysis is to go to 6 first and then analyze the permissive positions second. Now, when Governor Doyle issued his veto, he did it with the same knowledge. He's presumed to have knowledge of the law. So when he issued his veto on 5J, he would have done it with the knowledge that this court and the legislature said that 6D is protected. 6D is protected because the law says that you go to 6 first. If it's not prohibited, if it is prohibited, then you can't have it. You don't even get the 5J. So when the legislature didn't override his veto, they did it with that same knowledge. 6D and 5J are two completely different provisions. 6D makes it very clear in just a limited number of situations, uninsured and underinsured, and up to three vehicles, you cannot have language that prohibits stacking. 5J is a bigger piece of the pie. 5J applies to situations where you have drivers who have no insurance on the vehicle that are trying to get coverage from another policy on that vehicle, that's the free rider. 5J deals with situations, it says any coverage. It could apply to a liability coverage, it could apply to a medical pay coverage, it could apply to a death benefit if they wanted to include that in their policy. And under 5J, insurance companies are permitted to have drive other car exclusions. It also applies to situations in excess, as you heard, in excess of three policies. If you've got somebody who is a collector of old cars and they have 12 cars, they could stack up to 12 unless there's a drive other car exclusion in there. So that drive other car exclusion still exists. And 6D just takes a slice out of that pie, but the rest of 5J remains. So there is a purpose for 6D, there's a purpose of 5J, and it does exactly what Governor Doyle said he wanted to do when he indicated in his veto message that he wanted to be able to stack uninsured and underinsured up to three policies, but not allow people to take coverage that they didn't purchase and apply it to a vehicle for which there was no coverage. So he accomplished exactly what the governor's veto message intended that he wanted to do, and that's exactly what our legislature inherently intended by not overriding it. I believe my time is up.
So, Covelli.
Since 1990,
Belly, you better answer that argument.
Since 1995, the drive-other exclusion described in 5J was authorized and used by insurers. It was authorized by 5J. It was not authorized by 5E. 5E never came into play. Didn't have to. It was authorized by 5J. Insurance companies for 14 years had those provisions, that exclusion in their policy. In 2009, they saw the legislature considered repealing it. When the legislature did not repeal it, this statute that had been previously construed and the elements all set forth and continued to exempt it, they continued to use it because it was kept on the books. Now, there's nothing in the governor's speech that says, oh, we don't need to bar 5J anymore because 6D does it. He never said that. He said, I'm vetoing this because it may increase premiums. He wanted to give the consumer a lower cost choice in buying insurance so that they wouldn't be priced out. That's the reason he gave and the only reason he gave. 5E is a red herring in this case. If, as in Blake Kovic, we didn't meet the requirements of 5J, I'd say 5E applies, and they're absolutely right. You can do the 5E analysis. But 5E never comes into play here. It was authorized by 5J since 1995, after 2009, and to date. It's never, 5J has never been prohibited. Now, 5J2 says the second element is that it is not described in the policy under which the claim is made. They say 6D trumps 5J. I know of no Wisconsin law that says, other than implied repeal, that says one statute can trump another. I know of no law in Wisconsin that says this court can add language to a statute or subtract language from a statute because it thinks there's a conflict with some other statute. The Court of Appeals in Belding says 5J2, instead of saying it is not described in the policy under which the claim is made, they said it means a vehicle that the insured or a related member of the household owned but chose not to insure at all. How can you get that language out of 5J2? There is no ambiguity to, even if you want to say, gee, we better look at this hard because of 6D, there's nothing ambiguous about is not described in the policy under which the claim is made. That's exactly what you held it meant in Blake Kovic. The car to which the exclusion applies must not be described in the policy under which the underinsured motorist claim is made.
But Lakovich also set forth, based on Clark, a framework of analysis to determine the validity of an exclusion.
An exclusion that didn't comply with 5J. So if you look at Lakovich,
paragraph 12, it says, we begin our statutory interpretation with an examination of the language of 632.32.5e, which states that, quote, a policy may provide for exclusions not prohibited by sub 6 or other applicable law. Based on the statutory language, this court has fashioned a two-part test to determine the validity of a particular exclusion, citing Clark, and then it goes through that.
But before that, you said it's undisputed that the exclusion didn't meet 5J. That's why you're in 5E. You're in the catch-all because it was not authorized. In fact, you found it was prohibited by 5J. And so
you mean a unanimous court.
The unanimous court judge found that it violated 5J, therefore 5E couldn't apply. In this case, it doesn't violate 5J. So under Blake Kovic, you should say, well, 5E, is it okay under 5E? But my point is this. This court can't change the words of 5J2 because it thinks it conflicts with another statute. There is absolutely no authority for that. You can't rewrite a statute. More important.
Harmonize.
That's my next point, Your Honor. The duty of this
we court. We want to leave on harmony.
Okay. The duty of this court is to give full force and effect to both of these statutes because it's clear the legislature intended to retain 5J and intended to enact 6D. 5J already had been construed by this court. It was well known. The legislature was deemed to know that. 6D had never been construed. 6D could be narrowly construed to avoid any conflict between these statutes. It could be construed to mean what its words say, which is that no policy can have a provision that says the limits of the coverage cannot be added to the limits of another policy. The drive other car exclusion doesn't say that. The drive other car exclusion doesn't operate dependent on whether some other insurance exists. If it was the only policy, the drive other car exclusion would apply. There is no conflict because the other insurance clause in State Farm's policy says if the UM coverage on this policy applies to the accident and if other policies apply, then you have to stack at least three policies. In that, but the exclusion applied, so it, the if didn't exist. There was no coverage under the policy to stack.
Mr. Cavelli, your red light on, so if you would summarize quickly or sit down.
Your Honor, I think the first thing is there really a conflict, and can this court find a reasonable way to avoid the conflict? And I'm not saying that a narrow construction of 6D is the only possible construction. What I'm saying is it is the construction that avoids this apparent conflict. And that is this court's duty. Wherever possible, and I've cited the law at length, wherever possible, the court's duty is to avoid conflicts between statutes. It's to reconcile them so you can give full meaning to both. They say, well, we got this little chunk of it that is still there if you don't have any insurance. And I'm saying, but the statute says if it's not in the policy. And the real issue is, what have you taken away from us? What have you taken away? You've taken away the bulk of what the exclusion applies to, and the court can't rewrite the statute to do that. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cavelli. And thank you, Mr. Pitts and Lonergan, for your arguments today. We've had numerous cases on uninsured, underinsured, reduction clauses, other drivers' clauses, et cetera. And now we have yet another case, and this one involves a veto. So it's something new. That concludes our hearing on 12AP 829, Ronald E. Belding versus DeMolin. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third argument. I will be out shortly to discuss the procedures with the students, and anyone who wishes to stay may do so. You're all welcome. We are in recess.